Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this annual event for the Australian Business Economists on behalf of the Anika Foundation, featuring Dr. Philip Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. My name is Stephen Walters. I'm Chief Economist of New South Wales Treasury and Chair of the Australian Business Economists, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you today. As you can see, we're doing things virtually again this year because of the restrictions in Sydney, where most of us are located. Thank you for registering and for joining this event. I want to particularly welcome students and teachers from schools all over the country. At the outset, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land upon which I am located, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to the elders past and present and extend the same respect to all First Peoples, including the custodians of the lands where others may be located. Once again, NAB is the primary sponsor of the event today, as has been the case for some years now. So thank you again to NAB for being so generous. 100% of the proceeds from today's event goes to the foundation so they can continue their great work. Many of you already have donated to the foundation either personally or through your respective organisations. Thank you for that, and I encourage you to donate to this very worthy cause. Donations are tax deductible and GST free. The necessary details for making donations were included in the confirmation email for this event, and you can use these details until Monday, the 20th of September. Even very small contributions can help make a difference. Indeed, our main purpose today is to support the Anika Foundation. After a family tragedy, the foundation was established by our good friend, Dr. Adrian Blundell Wignall, back in 2005. To raise funds for research into adolescent depression and suicide. Normally, the ABE and the foundation would have seated around 500 people in a ballroom somewhere in the CBD, as we have done each year since 2006, with the exception of last year and today. And of course, that's still not possible this year. Instead, we have around 900 people registered for this virtual event, and it's fantastic to see so many people supporting the foundation. Very soon you'll hear from Professor Ian Hickey from the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney. Now, Ian will speak on the impact of the pandemic on mental health. And of course, we'll hear from Governor Lowe, who will speak soon on Delta, the economy and monetary policy. This is the fifth time that Phil has spoken to this event as Governor. And Phil, I thank you on behalf of the ABE for supporting this event once again. As has become a custom, Governor Lowe has agreed to take questions from the audience after his remarks. Now, these can be submitted during and after the speech in the question and answer tab on this platform. When submitting your question, just please remember to include your affiliation and your name. And I particularly encourage the many students who have joined us to submit their questions. With that, I'll now hand over to David Gall, Group Executive Corporate and Institutional Banking at NAB, who will introduce our speakers. David, over to you.
Look, thanks very much, Stephen. And on behalf of NAB, we're absolutely delighted to be here today as we continue the 16-year tradition of raising funds for the Anika Foundation. And together with the Foundation and the Australian Business Economists, we really are proud to co-sponsor this important dialogue on mental health, depression and suicide. A warm welcome to Dr. Philip Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, who will be addressing us shortly. Now, we've often, as you've just heard from Stephen, have a significant cohort of high school students in attendance also, and I'd like to call out a special welcome to those students joining us virtually today. And of course, a big thank you to all the NAB clients in attendance, and many of you have been strong supporters of this event over many years. Since its inception in 2005, the Anika Foundation has worked to better understand and improve mental health in young people and support research into adolescent depression and suicide. The mental health crisis brought on by COVID-19 as a shadow pandemic is affecting young people more than any other age group. And we're all feeling it. As a father of three young Australians and as a colleague of many parents, grandparents, aunties and uncles, I'm hearing about the impact on mental health every day. It's been a long 18 months of social distancing, remote learning and general uncertainty. Education and casual employment are more prominent in young people than people in midlife or even latter life. Both have been significantly impacted by the health crisis. Young Australians are also more dependent on their peer groups. The support systems around these people, whether it's teachers, parents, other structures and support, are obviously also stretched. I'd read recently that mental health screening has been recommended in all schools after research found 1/4 of young Australians experienced psychological stress and distress during 2020. A national survey of more than 25,000 people aged between 15 and 19 conducted during the pandemic last year found female, non-binary, Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander and young people with a disability were those that were most likely to be affected. And psychological distress can have a profound effect on a young person's experiences and choices that shape their life. Suicide continues to be the leading cause of death among young people aged between 15 to 44 in Australia, and there are more than 8 deaths by suicide in Australia each day. Continued research into mental health, depression, and suicide in young Australians is critically important, and it's a great privilege to be here today talking about this and, of course, raising funds. We recognise the New South Wales and Victorian outbreaks remain stubbornly high in the face of a strict lockdown measures and obviously a renewed focus on vaccination as the clear path forward. Pleasingly, the vaccination rollout is finding its gear, led by a sharp acceleration in New South Wales. And while restrictions are persistent in large parts of Australia for some weeks yet, vaccinations continue to provide a pathway towards reopening. And I think that pathway really offers hope for all Australians. NAB recently announced a partnership with UNICEF so that every time a NAB employee gets vaccinated, we'll pay it forward by fully vaccinating a person in need in our closest neighbouring countries, including Fiji and Papua New Guinea. And it's just really pleasing to see different corporates, different businesses and entities with programs that look like that. Our message is clear. Let's get on with it and support others too as well. And so whilst it might feel like we don't have full control over current events, it's important to remember that we can do many things to feel empowered and enabled. And one of those things is to get vaccinated. It also includes continuing to make connections and celebrating the work of the Anika Foundation to raise funds and share stories. I'd like to now hand over to Professor Ian Hickey from the University of Sydney. The University of Sydney is one of NAB's oldest clients, and it's terrific having an expert from their esteemed Brain and Mind Centre join us today. Professor Ian Hickey is co-director of health and policy at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre. He's a senior principal research fellow and was the inaugural commissioner on Australia's National Mental Health Commission, overseeing enhanced accountability for mental health reform and suicide prevention. He's internationally renowned researcher in clinical psychiatry, with particular reference to medical aspects of common mood disorders, depression, and bipolar disorder. Welcome, Professor Hickey.
Thank you so much, David, and thank you for everyone for attending. Just very briefly, I'd like to tell you about what the situation was for young Australians pre-COVID, what has happened during COVID, and what are the options that we have for supporting the mental health and development of young people in this country. So pre-COVID, unfortunately, over the last 10 years, the mental health of young people had significantly declined, not just in Australia, but across the Western world. So we're seeing increased rates of anxiety and depression in younger cohorts, younger teenagers, particularly younger women, and earlier ages of onset. That was happening pre-COVID. A lot of contested social theories as to why, the reasons are not that clear-cut, not simply technology. However, along comes COVID. Our general mental health and well-being depends on two real factors. One's personal autonomy, the capacity to live your life, earn an income, develop an education, take actions. The other, social connection. COVID represents, therefore, one of the most serious threats to those two main pillars of mental health and well-being that we're ever likely to see. In the models that we're associated with developing, complex models to inform social policy, models just like for the virus and its spread, we can do that in social policy. Not on how big the effect would be, but also on what actions governments could take and what we could take in communities to ameliorate those effects. In those models, we originally predicted if there was a very significant economic downturn, you may well see significant increases in suicide, in suicidal attempts, and particularly impacts on younger people because of the vulnerable stage of development that David just outlined, and because a lot of the educational disruption and early career disruption would most affect those people and would have the longest lag time into the future. We also was strongly in support of things like JobKeeper, enhanced job seeker, support for housing, moratoriums on closing down mortgages, etc. All of those social factors the government implemented that were likely to protect. We were strongly in favour of continuing those factors, not simply for their economic impact, but because they tied people to employment and to their communities on an ongoing basis. And that we would have modelled that they probably had significant ameliorating effects, and we did not see an increase in suicide rates so far. However, for young people, we've seen a very significant increase in anxiety and depression. We've seen a 47% increase in New South Wales in presentations to emergency departments with self-harm and suicidal behaviour, and estimates over 60% increase in Victoria after the extended lockdown last year. These impacts don't go away when the restrictions go away. The psychological injury persists. So we need to get out of the lockdown situation as soon as we possibly can when it's safe. But the psychological impacts and the impacts for young Australians will continue. We are very fortunate that the Anika Foundation is supporting a PhD scholarship with us to have people develop skills in these social and economic policies that are most likely to be of relevance to all Australians, to grow our collective mental wealth, but also to protect against the development of further adolescent anxiety and depression. That kind of investment in ongoing research using the same sort of sophisticated modelling that's done in economics, in other words, and other areas, is seriously needed in the mental health area. We're in danger of random acts of government, just funding all sorts of different things randomly, hoping they'll have an effect. What we need is systematic research, good modelling, and skilled personnel. It's through supporting the Anika Foundation that you can help us to continue to make those contributions and hopefully to continue to influence social policy so that we can respond in the most appropriate ways to the shadow pandemic, not just right now, but into future years. These are major challenges to the development of mental wealth in our country, and they need to be underpinned by good research and smart people providing advice into those who make their decisions. So thanks for coming today, and hopefully you can continue to support the Anika Foundation in its work.
Well, look, thanks very much, Professor Hickey, for those remarks. Now, continuing with tradition, I'd now like to welcome Dr. Philip Lowe, the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, to address us today. Dr. Lowe, as we heard before from Stephen, will be focusing his address on Delta, the economy and monetary policy. Dr. Lowe commenced as Governor in September 2016. He's Chair of the Reserve Bank Board and Payment Systems Board and Chair of the Council of Financial Regulators. He also serves on the FSB Steering Committee. Dr. Lowe is a signatory to the Banking and Finance Oath and Chair of the Financial Markets Foundation for Children, and a director of the Anika Foundation, which of course brings us all here today. Dr. Lowe has been a prominent voice in Australia for several years. Now, that said, he's had a profound impact through his steadying influence and voice of reason over the course of the pandemic. It's been a volatile time, and his calm and considered communications have helped to clarify where the focus should be for Australia's economic management. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Lowe.
Good afternoon, and David, thank you very much for your very generous introduction, and thank you also for the support that NAB is giving the Anika Foundation. And Professor Hickey, can I say thank you to you as well for your words there and for highlighting the important issues of mental health, particularly during the pandemic, for young people. This afternoon, I plan to talk about the implications of Delta for the economy and monetary policy. But before I do that, I too want to acknowledge the impact of the pandemic on young people. As we've just heard from Professor Hickey, the past 18 months have been very, very difficult for young Australians. We know their support networks have been disrupted, leaving many young people feeling isolated and unfortunately anxious about the future. Many have also missed out on events that would normally frame their lives, such as celebrating achievements with their peers, and their education's also been disrupted. And for many, it's been hard to get that valuable support that a one-on-one connection with a teacher can provide. So our young people are really paying a heavy price. As Professor Hickey said, this is evident in the increasing incidence of mental health issues and in the sharp rise in calls to support services. And as a parent of three children, I think it's important that we remember this high price when we do conduct a full accounting of the costs of the pandemic and the various containment measures. So it's in this context that I want to thank you all for your support of the Anika Foundation Your foundation is doing really important work in supporting the welfare and the mental health of young people. I really thank everyone on this call today for being part of that work. I'd now like to turn to the economy and to monetary policy. On the economy, our central message is that the Delta outbreak has delayed, but it's not derailed, the recovery of the Australian economy. The outbreak is clearly a significant setback for the country, and it's introduced an additional element of uncertainty into the future. But there is a clear path out of the current difficulties, and it's likely that we will return to a stronger economy next year. As you know, prior to the Delta outbreak, the Australian economy had considerable positive momentum. And you can see this in my first chart. Domestic final demand increased by 1.7% in the June quarter to be more than 3% above its pre-pandemic level. GDP was 0.7% higher in the June quarter and nearly 10% higher over the year. This was a better outcome than was seen in most other countries. But it was in the labour market where the positive momentum was most evident. In June, the employment to population ratio reached a record high of 63%, as you can see in this next chart, and the unemployment rate fell to 4.9%, and that was the lowest it had been in more than a decade. The number of job vacancies had also reached a record high in May, and there are increasing reports of labour shortages right across the country. So things were looking pretty positive, and at the Reserve Bank, we were contemplating a further upward revision to our economic forecasts. But then Delta hit. The result is that the economy will now contract significantly in the September quarter. Domestic demand will contract sharply, although stronger exports are expected to support the GDP figures. Our rough rule of thumb is that household consumption is around 15% lower during a lockdown than it otherwise would be. In addition, there have been disruptions to the construction sector and some investment plans have been delayed. The exact magnitude of the economic contraction in the September quarter remains to be determined, but it's likely to be at least 2% and possibly significantly larger than this. There's no doubt a major setback, but it is important to remember that it's likely to be only temporary. We expect the economy to be growing again in the December quarter with the recovery continuing into next year. The key drivers for the recovery are the increasing rate of vaccination and the prospective easing of restrictions on economic activity. Australia has made very significant progress on the vaccination front over the past month, and further progress is expected over the weeks ahead, which you can see in this next chart. In the past couple of weeks, around 1.25% of the population has been vaccinated each day, and that's at the higher end of international experience. As a result, more than 2/3 of the eligible population has now had a single vaccination, and more than 40% are double vaccinated. Our governments have indicated that as these figures continue to increase, restrictions on activity will be eased. When this happens, I think we can be confident that economic activity will begin to bounce back. While it's hard to be precise about the pace and the timing of this bounce back, in the RBA's central scenario, economic activity is expected to be back on its pre-Delta track by the second half of next year. One of the uncertainties here is the possibility of further significant restrictions on activity. These could come in response to new outbreaks of Delta or the emergence of a new strain of COVID or a decline in the potency of the current vaccines. In my view, these possibilities continue to represent the main downside risk to our economy. Another source of uncertainty is how Australians respond to the easing of restrictions. Given that this easing is likely to take place with COVID-19 still circulating in our community, this is quite different from our earlier experience when the number of cases was close to zero and there was a very quick bounce back. Whether the same will be the case this time remains to be seen. Much will depend upon our attitude to risk and how our society deals with the ongoing rate of infection. Experience overseas, though, provides an encouraging reference point. This experience suggests that having COVID-19 circulating in the community does not prevent a quick bounce back in spending, provided the population is highly vaccinated. Most people are keen to do the things they used to do, and they're keen to spend if they have the opportunity to do so and the income to do so. My expectation is that the same will be true here in Australia, although we still can't be sure what living with COVID-19 looks like in Australia. Another factor underpinning the view that the economy will bounce back is the substantial income support being provided by the Australian government and by the states and territories. Well, this support is different to that provided earlier. For many individuals, the value of that support is similar to that provided earlier. So with consumption restricted by the lockdowns, it's likely that the aggregate household saving rate will increase again in the September quarter. And the forecast for the saving rate in the September quarter is shown in this next chart. While the increase in the saving rate won't be as large as that which occurred last year, it will mean that many people have more money in the bank than they did pre-Delta. It's also relevant that broader measures of household wealth have increased quite significantly recently. You can see this in this chart. Housing prices are up 19% on the level they were before the pandemic, and Australian equity prices are around 10% higher than they were before the pandemic. This lift in the net wealth of the household sector is one of the things that suggests that once the restrictions are eased, households will be well placed to start spending again. I think for the business sector, it's more of a mixed picture. Many of the businesses we talk to at the moment are expecting an easing of restrictions later this year. They also remember that the labour market was tightening just a few months ago, and they're alive to the possibility that this could again be the case in the new year. This possibility is creating a strong incentive to keep in close contact with employees. After all, it doesn't make much sense to let workers go now, only to have trouble hiring them again when the restrictions are eased. Many large firms also have balance sheets that are in good shape, and they have expansion plans based on the expected easing of the restrictions. Business investment was on an upswing pre-Delta, and it's reasonable to expect that we will return to this upswing as the restrictions are eased, demand picks up and uncertainty starts to recede. At the same time, many small and medium-sized businesses are facing very difficult conditions. Many are in a wait, survive and see mode, having experienced a large drop in their revenue. Government assistance is clearly helping, but the longer these businesses have to wait before reopening, the more difficult things will become, and the greater the potential damage to this important part of the economy. For some small and medium-sized businesses, there is a limit to how long they can wait and see. So the sooner we can open up safely, the better. I would now like to turn to the labour market, where the numbers are going to be quite difficult to interpret over coming months. Hours worked, rather than headcount or employment, are likely to be the better guide, because the lockdowns have meant that many people are working reduced or 0 hours. I think the data for the unemployment rate will be especially hard to interpret. When people are stood down for more than 4 weeks without being paid by their employer, they are counted as either unemployed, if they're actively searching and available for other work, or they're counted as not in the labour force. This is the case even when they still have an attachment to their employer and can return to their jobs when the lockdowns end. This is quite different from the JobKeeper period, when government support was paid via firms' payrolls and many employees on 0 hours for extended periods were still classified as employed. In the current circumstances, they're more likely to be classified as out of the labour force. Nationwide, hours worked fell by 0.2% in July, and as you can see in this chart, there was a large decline in New South Wales, which was offset by increases in other states, including Victoria, where the lockdowns were briefly lifted. Looking ahead, total hours worked are expected to decline by 3 to 4% in the September quarter. There is uncertainty about what this means for the unemployment rate for the reasons I just spoke about, but it would not be surprising to see readings in the high fives for a short period of time. Is though a positive sign that forward-looking indicators of labour demand have held up reasonably well recently. You see this in this next chart. The number of job vacancies fell only a little in July and August, especially in New South Wales, and they're still at high levels. The decline so far in job vacancies and job ads has been modest compared with the decline of around 60% during the 2020 lockdown. Experience, though, differs quite a lot across industries. Hospitality, for example, has seen a similar decline in job advertisements to last year, although it's from a higher level, as you can see. Meanwhile, the hiring markets for engineers, for health workers, and for IT professionals have not been particularly affected. In the RBA's business liaison program, we hear frequent reports that firms are thinking twice before laying off staff. They recall the strong labour demand that was in place before the lockdowns, and many have an expectation that activity will recover strongly when the lockdowns end. But as I said earlier, this depends upon the easing of the restrictions and the increase in vaccination. I'd now like to turn to monetary policy, where I'll focus my remarks on the bond purchase program and the outlook for the cash rate. First, though, I want to emphasise that the RBA's package of monetary policy measures is providing ongoing and important support to the Australian economy as it deals with the Delta outbreak. This package includes a record low cash rate, a target of 10 basis points for the April 24 Australian government bond, a bond purchase program under which we have already purchased $200 billion of government bonds, with more to come, and a low-cost term funding facility for Australian banks, under which $188 billion has been provided for 3 years. This monetary policy package is working by keeping funding costs and lending rates low right across the country, by ensuring that the financial system is very liquid and the credit supply is available, by supporting household and business balance sheets, and by contributing to an exchange rate that is lower than it otherwise would be. It's through these transmission mechanisms that our policies are supporting and will continue to support the recovery of the Australian economy over the months ahead. At the Reserve Bank Board meeting last week, we considered how the bond purchase program should evolve in response to the Delta outbreak and the change to the economic outlook. The conclusion was that we will purchase $4 billion of bonds each week, as previously announced, but that we will extend the period over which we do this until at least mid-February next year. This conclusion reflected a number of considerations. The first and foremost is the delay in the economic recovery and the associated increase in uncertainty about the future. Given that the recovery has been delayed, we considered it appropriate that we delay any consideration of a further taper in our bond purchases until next year. By February, hopefully we'll know more about how the economy is responding to the easing restrictions than we would know in November. We also took account of the fact that the delayed recovery means that it will take longer to achieve our inflation goals. Continuing with the bond purchases at the announced rate for a longer period will also provide some additional insurance against the downside risks that I spoke about. A second consideration the board discussed was the appropriate roles of monetary policy and fiscal policy in response to the nature of the shock we're experiencing. The shock is largely the result of government efforts to contain the movement of people and to contain economic activity. The shock is also expected to be only temporary, given the expected easing of the containment measures over coming months. Throughout the pandemic, the RBA has seen its role as being part of a national effort to build a bridge to the other side and to make sure that the economy is well placed to rebound strongly when the time comes. As I discussed earlier, the package of policy measures introduced over the past year has helped build that bridge. But having already put that package in place, our assessment is that fiscal policy is the more effective policy instrument in dealing with the Delta outbreak. This is because fiscal policy can use the public balance sheet to offset the hit to private incomes during the lockdowns. In contrast, monetary policy works mainly on the demand side of the economy, and the effects on incomes are felt with a lag. Realistically, there is little more we can do to offset the hit to demand in the September and December quarters. This is the role for fiscal policy, and indeed there has been a sizable and a welcome fiscal response. A third and related issue we considered was that by continuing to purchase government bonds at the rate of $4 billion a week, we will be adding to the support provided to the economy during the recovery phase. The evidence suggests that It's the expected stock of central bank bond purchases that matters, rather than how many bonds the central bank buys in any particular week. By February, our cumulative purchases under the bond purchase program will have amounted to $275 billion. We will hold around 35% of the Australian government bonds on issue and 18% of the state and territory bonds on issue. As you can see in this next chart, the RBA's bond purchase program started later than that of most other central banks. Recently, it's been expanding faster relative to stock of bonds outstanding. This represents a substantial and an ongoing degree of support to the economic recovery. I'd now like to turn to the more traditional part of our monetary policy package, and that's the setting of the cash rate. As I've discussed on previous occasions, last year we moved to an approach under which actual inflation, rather than forecast inflation, plays the more central role in our cash rate decisions. In today's low inflation world, we do not want to run the risk that we increase the cash rate on the basis of a forecast that ultimately does not come to pass, leaving inflation stuck below the target band. We want to see results, not forecasted results, before we lift the cash rate. Once we do see those results, forecasts of inflation will again have a role to play. But we have to get there first. In particular, the board has said that it will not increase the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably within the 2 to 3% target range. It won't be enough for inflation to just sneak across the 2% line for a quarter or two. We want to see inflation around the middle of the target range and have reasonable confidence that inflation will not fall below the 2 to 3% target band again. Our judgment is that this condition for a lift in the cash rate will not be met before 2024. Meeting this condition will require a tighter labour market than we have now. Our assessment is that wages will need to be growing by at least 3%, and we remain well short of this. Even in industries where there's been really strong demand for labour, wage increases remain mostly modest. And this assessment was confirmed by the latest reading of the Wage Price Index, which showed an increase of just 1.7% over the year to the June quarter, with wages growth slower than this in the public sector. And you can see this in the Wage Price Index graph. Our judgment is that it will take some time for wage increases to lift to a rate that is consistent with achieving the inflation target. There is a lot of inertia in the wage setting process, and the experience of the past decade is unlikely to be reversed quickly. This inertia comes from, amongst other things, multi-year employment contracts, a very strong cost control mindset by Australian business, and from low and stable inflation expectations. Our judgment here stands in contrast to the expected path of the cash rate implied by market pricing, which you can see in this next chart. The current OIS curve implies a cash rate of around 25 basis points by the end of 2022, 60 basis points at the end of 23, and close to 100 basis points at the end of 24. These expectations are difficult to reconcile with the picture I just painted, and I find it difficult to understand why rate rises are being priced in next year or in early 2023. While policy rates might be increased in other countries over this time frame, the wage and inflation experience in Australia is quite different to these other countries, so what's happening elsewhere in the world doesn't need to apply directly here. Finally, I would like to address the question of housing prices. Some analysts have suggested we might lift the cash rate to cool the property market. I want to be clear that this is not on our agenda. While it's true that higher interest rates would, all else equal, see lower housing prices, they would also mean fewer jobs and lower wages growth. This is a poor trade-off in the current circumstances, and as I said, it's not on our agenda. That's not to say that there aren't public policy issues to be addressed here. On the financial side, the issue is the sustainability of trends in household borrowing, We're continuing to watch this closely with the Council of Financial Regulators, discussing possible regulatory steps if lending standards deteriorate or credit growth accelerates too much. More broadly, though, society-wide concerns about the level of housing prices are not best addressed through increasing interest rates or applying curbs on lending. While monetary policy is contributing to higher housing prices at the moment, the way to address these society-wide concerns about affordability is through the structural factors that influence the value of the land upon which our dwellings are built. These factors include the design of our taxation and social security systems, the planning system, zoning restrictions, the type of dwellings that we build, and the nature of our transportation networks. These are all obviously areas outside the domain of monetary policy and outside the domain of the central bank. Our job is to achieve the inflation target and support the return to full employment in Australia. The package of policy measures that we put in place has us on a path to do that. Delta is delaying progress along that path, but it's not expected to derail Australia's resilient economy. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you for supporting the Anika Foundation, and I'd be delighted to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil, for that very timely and topical speech, as always. So we'll launch ourselves into the adventure of the Q&A session. So we've got plenty of questions that are coming through, and I encourage the audience to keep sending them through. So I'm going to start with one of the schools, Governor. So it's from Michelle Bullen at Ravenswood. So given the low interest rate environment of the last couple of years, young people are wondering what this means for inflation pressures once the economy has recovered. So in the RBA boardroom, how do you evaluate the urgent short-term needs of the economy with those long-term effects before you make your monetary policy decisions?
I mean, our strategy at the moment is to support the recovery of the economy, to get the unemployment rate down, to get wages rising more quickly and have inflation return to the target. And I think if we can do that, people will have jobs and they'll get bigger wage rises to go with the jobs. And in the end, that's going to help not just young people, but everyone who's lucky enough to live in Australia. So that's a kind of our challenge, is to get more people into jobs and to get their wages rising more quickly. I know many young people are very concerned about the level of housing prices, and they blame the central bank for the high level of housing prices. And it's true that lower interest rates are having an effect. But as I said in my prepared remarks, there are much more important structural factors at play here. And if our society wants to address housing prices, I think we really need to tackle those structural factors. Ever rising housing prices relative to our income, I don't think serves our collective good very well. And something that as a citizen, I would like to see addressed. It's a central bank. We can't do anything about it.
Thank you, Phil. So there's one here from Stephen Helmerich, who's chief economist at CBA. And first, Stephen is a former chair of the ABE, says thank you, Governor, and really great to have your ongoing support. His question is on monetary policy. So is there a big difference between how strong the economy needs to be to continue to taper and eventually end bond purchases, and how strong the economy needs to be to actually raise interest rates, as you spoke about, or is it just a matter of time?
Well, it is a matter of time, but there is a difference. We're not going to raise the cash rate until inflation is sustainably within the 2 to 3% range. So we've got to actually achieve the results of that. On the bond purchases, we expect to have certainly tapered and then stopped those before we reach that target for inflation. I think what we're wanting to see on the bond purchases is substantial progress towards those goals, the goal of getting back to full employment and inflation in the 2 to 3% range. So once we're confident that, first of all, we see the progress and we're confident that progress will be continued, there'll be an opportunity to scale those bond purchases back further, because I think we all know, don't we, that we can't continue buying bonds forever. So most central banks are now considering tapering as they make progress towards their goals. They're kind of scaling back, and we'll find ourselves hopefully in the same position next year.
Thank you, Phil. You mentioned in your prepared remarks about the board has discussions about both monetary and fiscal policy. And there's a question from Robert Bruce about that. And he's framed it in the sense of, is there an ethical debate in the RBA boardroom about future interest rate management and the high level of debt that's capitalised against a future cohort of Australian families?
I'm not exactly sure what Robert is getting at here. He talks about kind of an ethical debate. But what we do talk about are the implications for the future vulnerability of the economy of households continuing to rack up debt at an ever-accelerating pace. So, as I said in my prepared remarks, through the Council of Financial Regulators, we've been discussing at least the hypothetical situation in which incomes are growing, say, at 5 or 6 and debt's growing at 10. And we look like that had become, if that was become the norm in Australia, I think that would be problematic. We're already a highly indebted, have a highly indebted household sector, and it's okay for a while for credit to be growing much faster than income, but given the very high level of debt we already have, my view is that it's not going to serve our collective interest to have debt rising at 10 or 11 or 12% a year when incomes are growing at half that. We're not in that situation yet, and we may not get there. I think if we got into that situation, both APRA and the Reserve Bank would be seriously considering whether there were regulatory measures that could be taken which would slow the rate of credit expansion. Not a situation I hope that we find ourselves in, but we can't rule that out.
Thank you, Phil. There's another question here from a student, and it's Sangeeta Narayan from Blacktown Boys High School. How resilient are the banks during this pandemic?
Very, very resilient. I mean, in the global financial crisis a decade ago, the not in Australia, but also around the world, the banks amplified the shock. In fact, in many cases, they were the source of the shock. In this case, the banks are absorbing the shock. They're helping the economy recover. They've been an important part of the Team Australia effort to build the bridge to the other side. And that's partly because of the regulatory changes that were made in the system over the past decade. Banks have a lot more capital. They have a lot more liquidity. Their risk management systems have improved. So I don't have any particular concerns about the health of the Australian banks. They're in good shape and they're helping the country absorb the shock as they should, and they're not amplifying the shock as they did previously.
Thank you. There's a question here from Sarah Hunter. With other central banks signalling that they will tighten policy sooner than you're suggesting, are you expecting an appreciation of the Aussie dollar over the next couple of years? And if so, how does this contribute to the recovery in the economy? And a follow-up question already, how much do international border restrictions limit the effectiveness of this channel?
Well, I've learnt over many years not to forecast the exchange rate. So my expectation is that the currency in a year's time will be where it is now, because that's what all the research shows, that the best forecast is the current value. So we're certainly not counting on an appreciation of the Australian dollar to drive the recovery. So the second part of the question was how much do international border restrictions limit the effectiveness of the channel? I don't see the depreciation of the currency being a central part of the recovery mechanism. So it's not, the international border restrictions are not having a particular influence on that element of the transmission mechanism. They are affecting, though, investments in the country. Through our business liaison program, we talk to businesses who want to invest. They need to bring a piece of capital equipment in from Germany or Japan. And when they install the capital equipment, they need to bring in the technician from either Germany or Japan. So they're having trouble doing that, or they're unsure about whether they'll be able to get the specialist labour from overseas to come in. And in some cases, that is leading them to delay or to push out those investment decisions. So one of the benefits that we will get when we're able to open the international border safely is that firms will have more confidence that they can invest and buy capital equipment from overseas.
No, thank you, Phil. There's a question here from James Crawford from CBUS. And what are you hearing from the business liaison unit about labour costs and wage pressures across industries at present? Presumably a shortage of labour in mining, for example. Are they paying higher wages as a result?
If you'd asked me this question in June, I would have told you that every single meeting that I have and my staff had with business, they were talking about labour shortages. Couldn't get the workers, didn't have the right skills, and it was becoming very, very difficult. And you saw that in the various business surveys where firms are reporting labour shortages as being one of the main constraints on production. By and large, we're obviously not hearing that at the moment. Firms have other concerns, and the concerns are the ones that are arising from the shutdowns. But I know many firms are looking forward to later in the year and early next year when the restrictions are eased and the possibility of those tight labour markets returning again. And this is one reason why I think we're seeing kind of firms try and keep an attachment to their workforce. In terms of wages, though, I've found it interesting that even in those parts of the labour market that have been tightest over up until June, there were, as you say, parts of mining, there was parts of construction, some professional services. Wages were rising more quickly, but more quickly wage rises maybe of 3 or maybe an outsized wage increase of 4. So that was the best we were doing in the tightest parts of the labour market. There are obviously some exceptions to that where some workers, cybersecurity specialists were getting bigger wage rises. But in general, even in the tight parts of the labour market, wage increases were 3 or 4. And the vast bulk of Australians were getting wage increases starting with a 1. So to me, this speaks to the huge amount of inertia in the system. There's been a lot of anchoring of wage expectations around 2. Firms want to keep control of costs. They're uncertain about the future, so they don't want to lock in larger wage increases. And this is all completely understandable. And this brings us back to our underlying strategy here of trying to create a tight labour market so that firms have to compete more aggressively for workers and pay wage increases starting with a 3 rather than a 1. And what type of labour market we need to achieve that, but it's hard to know, but my current judgment is that the unemployment rate needs to fall to the low 4s to get us in a position where wage increases start with a 3 rather than a 1. Time will tell that.
Thank you, Phil. There's a question here from Charles Hornery, and it's about cash in the economy. And Charles asked, with the trend accelerating for the reduced use of cash for transactions, as well as the broader digitalisation of the economy, what progress has the Reserve Bank made on issuing a new digital form of cash or a digital currency?
The progress we've made is really conceptual. And we haven't made that much progress. At the moment, our main focus is really on wholesale applications of central bank digital tokens. We've done a number of experiments with various parties, and we're currently involved in one with the BIS and Monetary Authority of Singapore and other central banks to look at cross-border payments. So in the wholesales area, there are a number of applications which we can see a strong business case for. In the retail space, I find it more difficult to find the underlying business case. At the moment, Australians can move money between their bank accounts using the MPP in 5 seconds. Most of us can do that from a mobile phone. We can do it very quickly and at no cost. So we already have a very effective payment system in Australia for moving money around very cheaply, at no cost, very quickly. So the alternative would be that rather than moving money between bank accounts, we hold value, not in the bank account, but in tokens on our mobile phones, and that we can move money between the electronic wallet on our mobile phone. So the issue, so that's the alternative world. Rather than moving money between bank accounts, we move it between electronic wallets. The issue we're trying to think through is what's the public policy case for that? There's obviously quite a substantial cost in the central bank building such a system, and would have implications, I think, for the operation of our own financial system as well. It may be in time that people find that a better way of transferring value between our electronic wallets rather than between our bank accounts. I'm yet to be convinced that it's the public policy case is there for us to invest what would be tens, hundreds of millions of dollars to ultimately build such a system which is secure, reliable, and serves the needs of 25 million people. And we already have a system that transfers value very efficiently. But if the day comes where that public policy case emerges, we'll be ready. We're doing work in the background to understand what the technology would involve, ultimately what the costs would involve, and conceptually what the risks are to the operation of the financial system. So we're continuing to look at it, but I'd be misleading you if I said that we're about to announce the operation of an EAUD operated by the central bank. But I can't rule it out forever, but we remain to be convinced of the public policy case for it.
Thanks, Phil. Very comprehensive answer. There's another question here from Ravenswood. This is from Zita Dimash this time. And we're starting to see a rise in prices due to rising costs, especially in the USA and Europe. And I'd add there perhaps container costs and shipping costs certainly going up around the world. Is the RBA concerned about a rise in inflation due to a shift in aggregate supply?
We're certainly watching the rising costs that you talked about. I think the US, what was the example that people have been focused on up until recently, was the rise in the cost of secondhand cars. There'd been an interruption to the global supply chain for new cars because of computer chips and people wanting to drive cars rather than catch public transport because of COVID. So the prices of secondhand cars went up a lot, and as you said in the question, transportation costs have gone up a lot as well because of rising container and shipping costs. I think the issue is this just transitory, or is it the first step to permanently higher inflation? It's a good question, and people are going to have different interpretations of it, but my view is that this is still largely transitory. There are disruptions to global supply chains. Used car example I was talking about, the problem here starts with computer chips. You know, South Korea and Taiwan have increased production. So I think the peak in chip prices is probably behind us. So the system recalibrates, it takes time. And as it recalibrates, some of the price pressures we've currently seen will dissipate. It would turn into persistently higher inflation if the temporary increase in inflation we're seeing now would have feed through into persistently higher wage increases. Because the two things go together, don't they? Higher inflation, higher wage increases. So to have persistently higher inflation, you've got to have persistently higher wage increases. And the experience of the last decade and a half, not just in Australia, but around the world, doesn't suggest that wage increases are going to kind of quickly ratchet up. There are these powerful structural forces that have been in operation for a couple of decades that are keeping wage increases fairly modest. And I don't think that a temporary period of supply disruption in computer chips and some other markets is going to fundamentally shift those dynamics in labour markets around the world. If it does, then we've really taken the first step to higher inflation persistently, but I don't think that's the most likely outcome here. But it's something to watch.
Thank you, Phil. There's another question here from a former chair of the ABE, Rob Henderson, and he too would like to thank you for your contribution to the foundation today. Rob's question is the statement you made about the cash rate not being lifted until inflation is securely within the target range. Unless the mean lag in the operation of monetary policy has become much shorter in recent years, doesn't this mean that the RBA may be risking an inflation overshoot if it doesn't tighten policy until inflation is already in target?
I think conceptually that's possible. Depends upon obviously what's going on in the dynamics in the economy at the time. But if inflation were to be in the high twos for a while or temporarily above three, given the experience we've had over the past decade or so, I don't see that as problematic, especially if we were confident it was going to come back to the anchor of the 2 to 3%. So it's it's possible that if we wait until inflation is really kind of close to 2.5%, that we'll have a period of inflation temporarily above 3%. Don't see that as particularly problematic as long as it's going to come back down again. And, you know, that remains the kind of the North Star for us, making sure that inflation is between 2 to 3% on average, and we'll adjust policy to make sure that happens. But, you know, that's a problem for tomorrow, isn't it? First of all, we've got to get and sustain the headline underlying inflation rate between 2 and 3. That's my priority at the moment.
Thanks, Bill. There's a question here from Leanne Taylor from CBUS. And thank you, Dr. Lowe, for your time and openness. Could you please share your underlying assumptions for the outlook for China and influence on global aggregate demand and implications for Australia, for example, commodity prices and service exports?
Thank you for the question. I mean, obviously, what's going on in China is incredibly important, not just for us, but for many other countries around the world. As you know, China is the major trading partner of a huge number of countries, including Australia. At the moment, there are a lot of moving pieces in the Chinese economy. I'm finding it increasingly hard to put all those pieces together. At the moment, the high-frequency indicators have softened a bit, at least in some areas of China. They've had to take quite stringent measures to shut down cases of COVID, so that I think is affecting economic activity in a number of areas. A second thing that we're seeing is in commentary by Chinese officials, much stronger focus on the concept of common prosperity and less on economic growth. In the past, Chinese officials would often, the first thing they would do would be to recite the very strong GDP figures. Increasingly, they're focusing on common prosperity, and we're all trying to understand what the ultimate implications are for that. In the financial sector, those who've been following this, there's Australian, a very large property company, Evergrande. You know, in the steel market, you see the Chinese authorities trying to contain emissions by effectively limiting steel production, just keeping prices high. But steel prices high, but iron ore prices have come down as effective limits on production. So you've got COVID, the concept of common prosperity, some stresses in the financial system, and their efforts to achieve their climate goals. So as I said, Stephen, there are a lot of moving parts there at the moment. We're continuing to watch all those moving parts very closely, and how they work out is obviously very important to us and to the globe.
Thanks, Bill. There's a question here from Ivan Colquhoun of NAB, who, of course, is our major sponsor for today. And Ivan's interested in the wisdom of using extremely low interest rate settings to try to boost wages. In previous speeches, you have pinned very low wages growth on factors such as technology and globalisation, but these are not particularly targetable with interest rates. There seem to be costs in running very low rates, and you've mentioned house prices a couple of times. Are there any other policies that could assist the RBA in achieving faster wages growth?
Well, the only policy we have at our disposal is kind of to boost aggregate demand. And as I said before, our strategy is to boost aggregate demand to the point that firms are having to compete more for labour. And I'm confident that if we can get the labour market being sufficiently tight, wage increases will lift. We saw that during the peak of the resources boom, when labour was in short supply, wage increases did lift. I don't think they're going to ratchet up quickly, but firms, if they're making profits, they want workers, and ultimately they're going to be prepared to pay for that. So that's the Reserve Bank strategy. Fiscal policy, of course, also influences aggregate demand, and fiscal policy has done a remarkable job in supporting aggregate demand over the past year and a half, and I very much welcome that. Once we get through COVID and things are kind of returning to normal, I think there's a legitimate discussion to be had about how the relative roles of fiscal and monetary policy evolve in influencing aggregate demand. That's outside of our control. What is in our control is the levers that we have to influence aggregate demand, and we're making sure that all those levers are pulled as hard as they can to get people into jobs, get firms to compete more for workers, and to get wage increases back to 3 point something.
Thank you, Phil. There's a question here from Michael Potter, and I think it's in the context of some comments you might have made earlier about the impact of immigration on wages growth. And Michael's asking, the RBA considers or seems to consider that immigration does affect wages growth, whereas Treasury does not hold that view. Can you reconcile this apparent difference of views, or is there a difference of views?
No, I don't think there is a difference of views here. I was disappointed in the reporting of my comments on this and a couple of months ago. I strongly believe that if you take a long-term perspective, that immigration has been a source of much of Australia's success. And actually, over time, the fact that we've been able to import people have come to Australia, want to build better lives, they've come with skills and resources, and that's made our country more dynamic, it's made it open, it's bigger, it's brought us to the world, and ultimately that's given us a higher standard of living. So I think that would be the view of Treasury as well. That doesn't preclude you also holding the view that against that long run trend, there can be times when elevated rates of people coming into Australia do affect the labour market. And my view is that we went through such a period up until fairly recently, the number of people coming into Australia was higher than it had been in the past, and the change was very quick. And in particularly for certain occupations, it was much easier for firms to go overseas and find workers with skills that are in short supply rather than compete for the resources in the existing labour market. And during the period where firms were able to do that, that did compress wages growth or slow wages growth for those skills. So long-term, fantastically beneficial for Australia, but there was a period there when the openness, the fact we were connected to the kind of global labour market did affect the supply dynamics in the Australian labour market. And prices are a balance of supply and demand. We change supply a lot, the price does adjust. And so it's a more sophisticated argument that many people would like to have, immigration good or bad, immigration fantastic over the longer term, but at the same time, it did affect the supply dynamics in the labour market for particular jobs, and that affected the wages of those jobs. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify that.
So, Phil, there's a question here from Nikki Hutley, independent economist, and it's about climate change. So given the size and duration of the COVID economic shocks, what lessons do you think we should take from this experience in relation to acting on and managing future shocks from climate change?
That's a very good question, but I'm not sure quite how to answer it because I don't know what to take away from COVID for climate change. I think what I can say is in the international meetings that I still have, largely via Zoom, I get a lot of questions, both from other central banks and by investors about climate change, Australia's preparedness for climate change, how our capital markets are evolving and how government policy is evolving. I think we all know this, that investors are increasingly applying a climate filter to their investment decisions. And they're applying that filter when they're thinking about investing in Australia, either in financial assets or real assets in the future. So there's a great deal of interest globally in our approach to climate change, and that filter is being applied, and I think will be increasingly applied. So it's important we have a positive story to sell there, because if we don't and that filter is applied and people don't like what they see, the cost of capital for Australia will go up. It'll be more difficult for firms to raise funds, and when they do, they'll pay more. I think Australia has some particular advantages here, and we need to be in a position where the global investors can see those advantages. So that's the lens that I bring to this, and the financial regulatory community is very aware of this, together with APRA. We're working on climate risk vulnerability assessments, and together with ASIC and the international bodies, increased disclosure of companies of climate change risk. So if people are going to apply this filter, which they are, companies need to put the information out there so that the investors can assess it, don't they? So the Council of Financial Regulators, we're very conscious of the fact that this filter is being applied. So we're doing the risk assessments and disclosure with ASIC.
So what COVID
means for climate change, I'm not sure. But
no, thank you. Look, we've had 48 questions submitted, so clearly we're not going to ask all of those, Phil, but I apologise to those whose questions I can't get to. I'll ask two more. Phil, this one is from Alicia Barry at the ABC. Thank you for your talk, and it's a broad outlook question. How concerned are you about potential new virus variants entering the country once borders open and further derailing the recovery?
Well, I can say it's one of the downside risks, isn't it, that we get new versions of COVID coming into the country and that leads to lockdowns. And when the lockdowns occur, economic activity is restrained and people don't have the jobs and incomes they once had. So it is a downside risk. It's certainly not the base case, though, that happens. Once the majority of the population are vaccinated, the medical advice, at least that I've read, has said that this risk of a new variant, while it's still there, it's not particularly high. I think the base case is most of us gets vaccinated, restrictions ease, firms start to feel that desire to hire and invest as they did did earlier in the year, and we go back to the previous track. So that's our base case, but we could get pushed off that again.
So we'll make this the last question, given we're running out of time and given we're supporting a very important foundation here. I thought it'd be a personal question that I'd end on. And it's from Jane Durham from Q Super. And Jane adds that she's a mother of three children. What does a bad day look like for the central bank governor? And what approaches do you use to move beyond this?
Just a bad day. I don't actually have many bad days, although I'd have to say last week I had a few bad days because I had to visit the hospital for a couple of days because my neck had frozen. A bad day for me, I think, is looking at a Zoom screen for 8 hours nonstop and keeping my neck in a single position, which I did for a couple of weeks, and I got to the point where it had frozen into position. So I can tell you that was a bad day for me, and as you can tell, I can move my neck now, and I've fully recovered. But I do see the stresses firsthand that the pandemic and the lockdowns are causing for young people. I think we all know, those of us with children, that they rely a huge amount on their social networks. They can't go to their parents and discuss every issue, can they? At least not in my household. But what they do is they go to their friends and they talk to their peers and their colleagues in the schoolyard, and they haven't been able to do that, and that does take a toll on them. They can't see their friends. So and I know my family's looking forward to the day when those social networks can be reestablished. It's okay doing it on Zoom, but it's not the same, is it? But especially for kids, the kind of those accidental contacts and the support they get from their peer networks. And I'd have to say their teachers as well. I see this with my kids, how the teachers have been supportive of them over the years. And they tell me it's just not the same talking to a teacher over Zoom. Can't hang back after all the other kids have left the classroom and say, having a problem with this kid. You can't do that anymore. So I don't have many bad days. I feel incredibly fortunate to live in such a great country. We've got a fantastic health system. Public administrations are very effective, and the economy is doing quite well. So I try and keep that perspective. And if you can see over my right shoulder, I still have the my half glass half full coffee mug. And I think we all need to remember how lucky we are to live in this great country.
Thank you, Phil. I think that's a great place to finish. So thank you again for your engagement today, as always, and for answering so many questions. Before we finish, I just wanted to draw your attention, the audience's attention, to upcoming ABE events that I hope you all can attend. So On the 12th of October, we have Dr. Martin Parkinson speaking to a virtual audience on national reform and the policy agenda. And then on the 16th of November, we plan to host Governor Lowe again for what we hope will be an in-person annual dinner. Fingers crossed on that, given the ongoing restrictions, but they should be being eased by then. So if not, we will look to do a virtual event again, without the meal, of course, unfortunately. And then finally, of course, in February next year, we are planning our annual conference as always. So I look forward to you joining us at any of or all of those events. And you'll find details and the links for registration on the ABE's website. With that, thanks again to Phil and Professor Hickey. I'll now hand over to Adrian Blundell-Wignall, the chairman of the Anika Foundation, who will offer the vote of thanks and close the event. Adrian, over to you.
Well, thank you, Steve. For those of you who may not know me, I'm the father of Anika and started this foundation. And it's basically with Glenn Stevens and with Phil Lowe that we've been able to raise, quite a big corpus to support all these scholarships and things that we provide, which includes PhDs, teacher scholarships, and also into the Aboriginal area. So it's been a fantastic thing. And as I say, Glenn and Phil have been really the key to the success of this foundation. So it just left me to sort of say, well, thanks to Phil first. Basically, writing a great speech. I mean, once more, every year I think he tries to make it one of the most interesting speeches of the year. So it's something to look forward to each year. And also, I just want to say that apart from being an excellent governor, Phil is just a very good person, and I really want to thank him. I'd also like to thank Professor Ian Hickey for accepting to take our new scholarship and focusing it on the set of issues for mental health that he spoke about earlier. Next, I wanted to thank NAB and David Gold for being here today for their sponsorship of this annual event, because it's not about just money and finance for NAB, and this is really about the sort of society we live in. And I think that more corporates taking an interest in these issues is really, I think, one of the things that is going to be, forming the sort of society we live in is going to be one of the most important things that we can leave our kids. And finally, if I could just thank the ABE, without whose Rolodex this event would not be possible. And certainly like to thank particularly Steve Wallace, the chair of the ABE, who did a great job in the questions just now. And also someone who works behind the scenes and doesn't get much accolades is Tony Westmore. He ran the show that we all looked at today, and also I interact with him a lot through the year, and he did a really great job. So with all of that, I'd just like to say personally thank you to everyone who attended. Thanks for supporting the foundation, and let's hope that Professor Hickey and some of the other scholarships we do are going to really produce the sort of research which is going to help. So thank you, and we'll see you next year, I hope. Thank you.
Thank you very much.